Unquestioned assumptions. A piece put together for this book from notes for workshops and talks to writers during the 90s.
Hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère et ma sœur.
This essay is the somewhat grouchy result of years of reading stories, workshop manuscripts, and printed books that include me, the reader, in a group I don't belong to and don't want to belong to. You're just like me, you're one of us, the writer tells me, and I want to shout, I'm not. You don't know who I am. We writers of fiction don't know who reads us. We can make some limited assumptions about our readers only if we write for a publication with a restricted readership, such as a campus literary periodical, or a magazine with a specific religious or commercial affiliation, or in a strictly coded genre such as the Regency romance. And even then, it's unwise to assume that your readers think the way you do about anything. Race, sex, religion, politics, youth, age, oysters, dogs, dirt, Mozart, anything. The unquestioned assumption, the mistake of thinking we all think alike, is less often made by writers who belong to a minority or oppressed social group. They know all too clearly the difference between us and them. The confusion of us with everybody is most tempting to people who are members of one or more of the privileged or dominant groups in their society, or in an isolated or sheltered social environment such as a college, or a white American neighborhood, or a newspaper editorial staff. The premise is, everybody's like me and we all think alike. Its corollary is, people who don't think like me don't matter. The supposed phenomenon of political correctness, a conspiracy by bleeding-heart liberals to keep us ordinary folks from talking the normal, ordinary, just-folks-down-home way and calling a spade, exhibits the corollary as an article of belief invoked to defend various bigotries. Arrogance is usually ignorant. It can be innocent. Children's ignorance of how others think and feel has to be forgiven while it's being corrected. Many adults in communities isolated by geography or poverty have known only people like themselves of their own community, creed, values, assumptions, and so on. But these days, no writer can legitimately claim either ignorance or innocence as a defense of prejudice or bigotry in their writing. How does anybody know anything about other people's minds and feelings? Through experience, yes. But fiction writers get and handle a great part of their experience through their imagination and pass it on to their readers entirely through the same channel. Knowledge concerning the enormous differences among people is there for any reader, no matter how isolated and protected. And a writer who doesn't read is inexcusable. Even on television, you can see that people are different. Sometimes. I'll talk about four common varieties of the unquestioned assumption and explore a fifth one in more detail. Number one, we're all men. This assumption turns up in fiction in endless ways, in the belief, borne out by the entire substance of the book, that what men do is of universal interest, while women's occupations are trivial, so that men are the proper focus of story, women peripheral to it. In women being observed only as they relate to men, and their conversation reported only as it relates to men, in vivid descriptions of the bodies and faces of sexually attractive young women, but not of men or older women, in presuming the reader will welcome misogynistic statements, in pretending the pronoun he includes both genders, and so on. This assumption went almost unquestioned in literature until fairly recently. It's still fiercely upheld as legitimate by reactionary and misogynist writers and critics, and is still defended by people who feel that to question it is to question the authority of great writers who accepted it in good faith. It should by now be unnecessary to say that such defensiveness is unnecessary. But alas, the New York Times and many academic bastions and bulwarks are still staunchly protecting us from the rabid hordes of man-eating bra burners out to diminish Shakespeare and demonize Melville. How long will it be, I wonder, before these brave defenders notice that feminist criticism has vastly enriched our reading of such authors by bringing to an area of darkness and denial a mild, honest illumination of cultural relativism and historical awareness? Number two, we're all white. This assumption is implied far, far too often in fiction by the authors mentioning the skin color only of non-white characters. This is to imply unmistakably that white is normal, anything else is abnormal, other, not us. Like misogyny, actual racial contempt and hatred, often expressed with appalling brutality and self-righteousness, is so frequent in older fiction as to be inescapable. There, the reader can only handle it with, again, historical awareness, which asks for tolerance, though it may or may not lead to forgiveness. Number three, we're all straight. Of course. All sexual attraction, any sexual activity in the story, is heterosexual, of course. This unquestioned assumption applies to most naive fiction even now, whether the naivete is deliberate or not. Straightness as dominant in-group may also be implied by the nudge and snigger. A negatively stereotyped fag or dyke is presented by the author with a verbal wink, an invitation to more or less hateful laughter from the reader. Number four, we're all Christian. Writers who have not noticed that Christianity is not the universal religion of humankind, or who believe that it is the only valid religion of humankind, are likely to take it for granted that the reader will automatically and appropriately respond to Christian imagery and vocabulary, the Virgin Mother, sin, salvation, and so on. Such writers take a free ride on the cross. In 15th century Europe, this assumption was forgivable. In modern fiction, it is, at best, unwise. A particularly silly sub-in-group is made up of Catholic or ex-Catholic writers convinced that all readers went to parochial school and are obsessed, one way or another, with nuns. Much more frightening than these are the writers whose description of non-Christian characters exhibits their conviction that outside Christianity there is no spirituality and no morality. Special grace extended to the occasional good Jew or honest unbeliever merely includes that individual in the Christian exclusivity. Monotheistic bigotry beats all. The fifth group that assumes itself to be universal deserves special examination because it's not often talked about in the context of fiction. The assumption that we're all young is a complex one. Our experience of age changes as our age changes, constantly. And age prejudice runs both ways. Some people carry their in-group right through life. When they're young, they despise anybody over 30. When they're middle-aged, they dismiss the young and the old. When they're old, they hate kids. 80 years of prejudice. Men, whites, straights, and Christians are privileged groups in American society. They have power. Youth is not a power group, but it is a privileged or dominant one in college, in fashion, film, popular music, sports, and the advertising that sets so many norms for us. The tendency at present is to adulate youth without respecting it and sentimentalize old age while despising it, and to segregate both. In most social situations and at work, including educational work, adults, except for a few designated as caretakers or teachers, are kept segregated from children. The interests of the young and the interests of adults are supposed to be entirely different. Nothing but the family is left as a meeting ground. And though politicians, preachers, and pundits prate about the family, few seem to want to look at what it consists of. Many contemporary families consist of one adult and one child. a subminimal social group with a single-generation age spread. Divorce and remarriage can create large, semi-dispersed families, but even children with a slew of parents, step-parents, and step-siblings often don't know anybody over 50. Many older people, by choice or perforce, have no contact with children at all. I don't know why this curious skewing and segregation of society by age should induce writers to use a youthful viewpoint as if it were the only one, but a great many of them do. The unquestioned assumption is that all readers are young or identify with the young. The young are us. Older people are them, outsiders. And to be sure, every adult was a child, was an adolescent. We've been there. We shared the experience. But we aren't there now. Most readers of adult fiction are adults. A great many book readers are also parents or accept parental responsibility in one way or another. This means that though they may identify with the young, their identification isn't simple. It's extremely complex. It's not a belonging, nor is it mere recollection. Adults who accept their social or personal responsibility towards children and young people, and who don't need to deny that they were themselves young, have a double or multiple point of view, not a single one. To write from the child's or adolescent's point of view is, of course, natural in books written for children or young adults. In books written for adults, it is a valid and often powerful literary device. It may simply fulfill nostalgic yearnings to be young again, but the innocent viewpoint is inherently ironic, and in a wise writer's hands may imply the double vision of the adult with particular subtlety. In much recent fiction written for adults, however, the child's vision is not used ironically or to increase complexity, but is implicitly or openly valued over the depth of vision of the adult. This is nostalgia with a vengeance. In such books, an absolute division between adult and child is made, and a judgment is based on it. Adults are perceived as less fully human than children or young people, and the reader is expected to accept this perception. Parents and authority figures of any kind are presented without compassion or comprehension as automatic enemies, all-powerful wielders of arbitrary power. There may be a few saintly, all-comprehending exceptions proving the rule. Powerless old folks, grandparent figures rich in the primitive wisdom of another, note the word, race. Sentimentality fawns on oversimplification. As a dead white man of the ruling class remarked, power corrupts. To the extent that adults have more power than kids, adults are inarguably corrupt, while kids are at least relatively innocent. But innocence is not what defines people as human, it's what we share with the animals. An adult, indeed, may have absolute power over a child and may abuse it. But even truthful, valid descriptions of abuse are weakened when the writer's point of view is childish or infantile. To accept the infantile view of adulthood as omnipotent, readers must abandon their hard-earned knowledge that most adults, in fact, have very little power of any kind. I will use the same two books as examples as I did in the previous essay on fictional characters, David Copperfield and Huckleberry Finn. We are caught in and share young David's perception of his stepfather's cruelty, but Dickens' novel is not about a child abused by jealous and hateful adults. It is about a child growing up, becoming a man, a complete human being. All David's mistakes, in fact, are the same mistake repeated, a child misperception of false authority as real, which prevents him from valuing the real help that is always at hand for him. By the end of the book, he has outgrown the infantile myths that held him helpless. Dickens as a child was, in many respects, David, but Dickens the novelist does not confuse himself with that child. He keeps the complex, hard-earned vision. And so David Copperfield, fearfully acute in its understanding of how children suffer, is a book for adults. Contrast J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, The author adopts the childish view of adults as inhumanly powerful and uncomprehending and never goes beyond it. And so his novel, published for adults, is better appreciated by 10-year-olds. The childish point of view and the child's point of view aren't necessarily the same thing. A good deal of Tom Sawyer is a rather uneasy mixture of the two, but Huckleberry Finn, though narrated in a boy's voice, has nothing childish in it. Behind Huck's limited vocabulary, perceptions, and speculations, his ignorances, misconceptions, and prejudices, is the steadfast, lucid, ironic intelligence of the author. And it is through that intelligence that we understand and feel Huck's moral dilemma, which he has such difficulty understanding himself. When I read the book as a kid Huck's age, I understood that, as well as anybody under 18 understands irony, so I could read with understanding, even when shocked by some of the language and events, until I came to the episode where the boys, at Tom's insistence, imprison and torment Jim. There I saw the black man I had come to love, powerless in the hands of the white children, his fear and grief and patience ignored and devalued. And I thought Twain himself had joined in the wicked game. I thought he approved of it. I didn't understand that he was satirizing the cruel mockeries of Reconstruction. I needed that historical knowledge to understand what Twain was doing, that he was honoring me by including me in the same humanity with Jim. Throughout Huckleberry Finn, the boy's unquestioned assumptions, which are those of his society, and the author's convictions and perceptions, which are frequently counter to those of his society, contradict each other deliberately and shockingly. It is a profoundly complex, dangerous book. Those who want literature to be safe will never forgive it for being dangerous. Each unquestioned assumption has a possible opposite, a reverse, which, if written into fiction, would give us stories in which men occur only as sexual objects for women, where homosexuality is the social norm, where white skin has to be mentioned whenever it appears, where only godless anarchists act morally, or where adults rebel vainly against the bullying authority of children. Such books are, in my experience, rare. One might meet them in science fiction. Realistic fiction that merely questions or ignores the assumptions, however, is not unusual. We do have novels that assume that women represent humanity as well as men do, that gays or people of color or non-Christians represent humanity as well as heterosexuals, whites, or Christians do, or that the adult or parental point of view is as valuable as the childish one. The stigma of political correctness, invoked by those who see all refusal of bigotry as a liberal conspiracy, may be slapped on such books. They are often ghettoized by publishers and reviewers, segregated from fiction of general interest. If a novel is centered on the doings of men, or its major characters are male, white, straight, and or young, nothing is said about them as members of a group, and the story is assumed to be of general interest. If the major characters are women, or black, or gay, or old, reviewers are likely to say that the book is about that group, and it is assumed, even by sympathetic reviewers, to be of interest chiefly or only to that group. Thus, both the critical establishment and the publisher's publicity and distribution tactics lend immense authority to prejudice. A writer may not want to defy both the reactionary critical establishment and the pusillanimous marketplace. I just want to write this novel about the kind of people I know. I just want to sell my book. Fair enough. But how much collusion with prejudice, disguised as unquestioned assumptions about what is normal, does it take to buy safety? The risk is real. Look again at Mark Twain. Huckleberry Finn is still getting bad-mouthed, banned, and censored because its characters use the word nigger, and for other reasons, all having to do with race. Those who allow it to be thus abused in the name of equality include people who think teenagers are incapable of understanding historical context, people who believe education for good involves suppressing knowledge of evil, people who refuse to understand a complex moral purpose, and people who distrust or fear secular literature as a tool of moral and social education. A dangerous book will always be in danger from those it threatens with the demand that they question their assumptions. They'd rather hang on to the assumptions and ban the book. Safety lies in catering to the in-group. We are not all brave. All I would ask of writers who find it hard to question the universal validity of their personal opinions and affiliations is that they consider this. Every group we belong to, by gender, sex, race, religion, age, is an in-group, surrounded by an immense out-group, living next door and all over the world, who will be alive as far into the future as humanity has a future. That out-group is called other people. It is for them that we write.